Hello, and welcome back to another episode of You Can Survive, Let's Talk About Cancer. I'm your host, Arzu, a cancer survivor, as well as cancer champion for the patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. I'm also part of the Cancer Smart initiative, which is an exciting opportunity to help tackle cancer and its associated inequalities in West Yorkshire and Harrogate. In particular, we're looking at how we can help improve outcomes of cancer patients through early diagnosis and screening and provision of preventative advice. On today's episode, I am very excited to be joined by two guests, one of which we interviewed not too long ago. He's a fellow cancer survivor and cancer champion, Rob. Welcome to the podcast, Rob.
Hi, Azu. Hello, everyone.
And also, we both will be interviewing an incredibly brave young man who's seen a lot of hardship since a very young age, only 14 years. His resilience, drive, and willpower allowed him to defeat cancer not just once, but twice, which is incredible. He is another fellow cancer survivor, as I just mentioned, and an advocate for cancer, Ryan. Welcome to the podcast, Ryan.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Pretty good, thank you.
I say, that was a really smooth intro, I've got to say. I've been on a few podcasts, but that's you've nailed it right there. That's probably one of the best I've heard in a while.
I'm glad. And how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. The sun's been shining. I've been out for a walk on my lunch break. So, yeah, good. How are you guys?
We're good. So, thank you so much for joining us today and agreeing to share your story. We're definitely all very excited to hear your story, and as will be our listeners. If you don't mind, would you like to sort of tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Ryan Harvey. It's spelled differently to normal. It's spelled with an I, so it's R-I-A-N. And that's because I've got Irish heritage. It's my grandmother named me. And she wanted to choose the Irish name, so we went with that. And unfortunately not around anymore. It's not my last sort of legacy I got of her, so I think it's a really cool name to have. I really enjoy having it. I used to hate it, but I like it now. But yeah, obviously my name is Ryan Harvey. I've sort of dubbed myself the L card, which I'll sort of dive into a bit later as to why that is that name. Right. But yeah, at 14 years old, as you said, I was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia, which is an aggressive cancer, an aggressive form of leukemia. I basically went from being a teenager, as everyone sort of does in these situations, never, ever really being ill, never been to doctors really, other than just your average checkups or vaccinations. And then I found myself in A&E with what I thought was a blood clot, but turned out to be blood poisoning. An infection in my leg, and then they found cancer there as well. So my life sort of flipped very, very quickly at a young age. And as you said, I got better. I had chemotherapy. I did potentially face losing my leg from the blood poisoning, but I was very fortunate to keep that in the first week. Against all of my consultant's odds, she really thought that I wasn't going to make it. I managed to pull through the first treatment. So I had 6 months of intense chemo. Spent Christmas in hospital, but got to say it's one of the best Christmases I've ever had. And we were, sort of carted back into life for a year. I managed a year, a full 12 months. Went traveling, went to Italy for a wedding, went to Qatar, wow. Got back up my schoolwork again. And then 12 months later at Christmas, I started noticing symptoms again. And they started building up, went from sort of nosebleeds to paleness to loss of appetite. And I didn't tell anybody because I knew what was happening. And I was terrified of what that meant. I was scared that because I was relapsing, I think I could feel what was going on because of that. I thought, I don't want to tell anybody. And I did the old classic fashion teenager thing that we all do, is if I ignore it, the problem will go away. Which obviously that kind of problem is never going to leave. Don't tell anybody. So I was happy that I did in the end. But I left it 3 months and I left it. I basically left it right up to the wire. We had one year in remission. Anniversary party where I felt a bit like a fraud, sat around at the table where everyone was sort of doing talks and stuff, saying, oh yeah, you got this far into remission, and I knew full well what was going on. Woke up the next morning, my lymph node was swollen up. I woke up with a blood clot in my mouth, and I went through to the kitchen and told mum that I needed to go to hospital to get checked, and I did. Then the consultant told me what I pretty much already knew that my cancer was back, the leukemia was back, and it was quite far developed in the sense that my blood results that he took that day were the lowest that he'd ever seen during his whole career. Wow. In terms of my platelets were like rock bottom. My white blood cells were obviously through the roof because of the leukemia. My red blood cells were basically non-existent. And he said basically, if I hadn't gone in that day, he couldn't have guaranteed that in a week's time, I would have been around. I was given a platelet top up that day, sent back home, told to go to Southampton Hospital the next day to restart treatment. Had a bone marrow biopsy, and then they found that I had 98% leukemic cells in my bone marrow. So I was sort of quite consumed by it. And my option was a stem cell transplant. So I'm a sibling. I've got four siblings, unrelated, four little sisters. I love them all dearly. Annoying, but love them dearly. and because they're stepsisters, they wouldn't have ever been a match. So there was no point in even testing them. So my sort of fate laid with a stranger, hopefully being on the register, that was a match for me. Anthony Nolan, DKMS, NHS. They all started searching the register to find me a match. And I think it took us 60 days. And then we found a match. So we managed to find a 10 out of 10 donor. And very, very lucky to do that. And then a couple of months later, on the 1st of July 2015, I received the transplant. And since then, I've just sort of gone through the motions of getting past cancer and sort of getting to this part now and then talking to you guys.
Wow, that is an incredible journey, and you've gone through so much. But just in, like I said, 5 minutes, you've wrapped up a very long journey. But we know how difficult it is as cancer survivors now, and thrivers, you know, just going through that. It's a very, you know, life-changing event. You know, it changes you as a person. It changes many aspects of your life. And even though you've made it sound so easy and you're here today sharing so much positivity, I can, you know, tell our listeners how difficult that journey is and how much resilience it takes to get out of the other end, especially, you know, listening to your story and how you relapsed and you had to go through it twice. It's truly inspirational and very commendable. And just, you know, coming to the point of your diagnosis, you mentioned how the second time around you were more hesitant, and the first time around, I think it was an infection or blood clot that sort of prompted you to, you know, seek that medical advice. What were your thoughts the first time around in terms of it being cancer? You know, you were only 14. Did that thought even cross your mind or?
No, so I spent basically the whole of the summer holidays with symptoms slowly starting. And the first symptom I remember was, I think it was like the second night of summer holidays, I was sleeping at my friend's house and I woke up in the middle of the night caked in sweat. And obviously you see within cancer people sort of all these symptoms, everything shadowed by things you can sort of relate them to on a regular day-to-day basis. So night sweats was my first thing. But I was a 14-year-old boy and it was summer holidays and it was 24 degrees and I have to sleep with a duvet. I can't just sleep with a sheet. I've got to sleep with a duvet. So I was thinking, look, this is normal. Like, I'm sweating, it's fine. And these things persisted. The first thing that sort of scared me a bit that I thought isn't quite normal was lightheadedness and feeling like I was walking on clouds. But again, it came and went quick enough for me to just think, right, this isn't anything to worry about. So let's just carry on. And even when my legs started playing up, you know, now I look back, I was extremely unwell before I went into A&E, really unwell. I was sort of wake up in the middle of the night having panic attacks. I couldn't walk properly because my leg was sort of jarring into like a 40 degree angle because of the infection. Right. I didn't think it was an infection. We'd been to the GP because when we went to the GP originally, it wasn't really anything. It was just a sore leg. So he gave us some cream for muscle injury. He obviously thought I played football, thought maybe it's one of them. We put the ointment on, nothing happened. It got warmer. It was actually my stepdad who picked up on it. He said that this is warm, we need to get this checked out, it must be an infection. And that's when a doctor referred us to for an x-ray. The x-ray showed nothing, and then mum said, let's go to A&E, because my granddad had deep vein thrombosis, which is a blood clot in the leg before. So she was, this could be something like that, so let's get this checked out, because that can be fatal. And even when we sat in A&E, we were seen very quickly. The wait time was 3 hours. We were seen within 20 minutes, because they knew what the symptoms were. As soon as we explained the symptoms to the triage doctor, she put us into a pediatric trauma room. I remember seeing the words trauma and like, no, I'm not a medical professional, but I watched enough casualty to know that trauma is a bad thing. and moved into this room, and still nothing was twigging that this was going to be as serious as something like cancer. And I was just thinking, potentially an infection, I might spend a night or two in hospital and we'll be on our way. And even when mum got called out of the room to speak to the consultant, again, I thought, yeah, this is probably bad, but I didn't think it was going to be that extent. And then it's when he told me, that's obviously when I knew it was leukemia. I didn't straight away twig that was cancer, because it's not often, especially at that age, the education's not there that much that you know that leukemia and cancer are the same thing. They are the same thing. The only reason I knew that leukemia was bad, because there was a footballer who had it for Aston Villa. And he, like, in the news on Match of the Day and stuff, all the programs and the magazines that I read, and they're sort of keeping up on his treatment. So I knew that it was a bad thing. But I don't think I ever twigged that would be it. And one thing I think is worth mentioning as well is when I got to the Children's Cancer Ward, even though I knew children had cancer, because you've got things like Children Need, which cover it, and Comic Relief, and now with things like Stand Up to Cancer, etc.
Yeah.
Even though I knew children had it, when I got to the ward, it shocked me how many children have it. And like, that wasn't even, there's 15 beds on the ward that were all filled all the time. But then thousands of patients are on maintenance and chemotherapy for day trips, chemotherapy, not inpatients. And it was like, okay, wow, like, this is a new world that's been right near me my whole life that I've never, ever known about. Or it's been like a hidden world that you don't know about, like you see in films.
Absolutely. And like, just to add to what you've said, like, starting with the symptoms, they're quite common and vague symptoms. Like, nobody would assume that because they're dizzy or they're feeling extremely tired, for example, or their legs sore, that it can be cancer. That's never an initial thought, especially at the age of 14 years. So it's quite, understandable why that wasn't something that you thought could be wrong with you, especially because you don't even understand what cancer is at that particular age anyways. And no parent would want to even imagine or make the assumption that their child could have cancer either. So I think it really explains how your initial journey of getting diagnosed was very much getting these symptoms, ignoring them, thinking that they'll get better and go away, because that's how we humans feel our bodies are. Like, we'd get a symptom and we'd say, oh, it's go away, it's nothing to be concerned about. However, the important point here is to see your GP and to always make sure you get your symptoms checked, because if it's nothing, then that's great. But if it is something that could be potentially, serious and could dictate the outcome, for example, for you and whether you survive or not, then it is, a life-changing decision that you're going to make about going to see your GP. So I think, your experience and my own personally, they just tell us how important it is to always get yourself checked up and ask for that professional help and that medical advice, because we aren't medically trained. We don't know what a certain symptom could potentially mean. And with cancer, you don't always get the red flag symptoms of a blood clot, for example, or bleeding or weight loss. It's usually, for a lot of cancers, very vague symptoms that we all have experienced at some point in our life.
Yeah.
And And like, with the aspect of children getting cancer, I did a bit of research on leukemia yesterday, and I came across a statistic that acute myeloid leukemia is most commonly seen in those over 75 years.
Yeah.
Much older people. So like, thinking about a 14-year-old getting this particular leukemia, it wouldn't necessarily cross anyone's mind, even that of healthcare professionals, because a lot of these cancers, they're more common in with advancing age. So it's something that we need to increase awareness about, and that is children getting cancer and how there's so many children who have a number of different cancers that we're not aware of as the general public, and even healthcare professionals can miss, because from the statistical epidemiology side of things, it's not commonly occurring in that age group. So you wouldn't necessarily jump to that conclusion to begin with anyways.
Absolutely. And like you said, the GPs have got such a big job to do, and they're not, they've got to rule out a million things when a patient comes to them. And like you say, the first thing on the checklist, I imagine personally, from my GP's perspective, that I was going to my GP, school was about to start. What's going to be coming to this straight? Well, there's a teenager right now that school's about to start. He's come to the GP like 2 days before school starts. Okay, right. Yeah. Let's have a little think about this one. It's not rushed or anything, because it's just classic things that happen like that, isn't it? And like you say, human nature is that you don't. An interesting thing about the symptoms you're saying there, obviously they're very common, and like you say, the body, we tend to sort of have these small symptoms and disappear. Leukemia Care ran a campaign during the lockdown in the pandemic, because a lot of the symptoms, that especially for leukemia, were mirroring that of COVID. So right. a lot of people weren't going to the doctors because they're like, I've got COVID. Mm. Or they're having tests and it was coming back negative. And then actually they'd go over a blood test a couple of months later and they've got leukemia or cancer because the symptoms are similar. One thing a consultant said to me, which really has sort of stuck with me that my whole life, and it's when they stopped doing blood tests on me after a certain amount of treatments. So I hated them anyway, and they just sort of got to the point after a certain amount of checkups, look, let's not put him through this added stress on his checkups. Let's just see how he is. We can sort of sense how he is when we see him. And we're going to stop doing blood tests. And I remember being a bit cagey about it to start off with, but he said, look, you will know before any of us if something's wrong with your body. And mm-hmm. I think that's the same for anybody. I think it's enhanced more when you've been through something like this. But honestly, when you speak to somebody, if I say hand on heart, when I was having my symptoms originally, if I was to really ask myself what was wrong with me, it was something serious because something was going on there. It was sticking around. I think it's about people being honest and really trying to understand their own body as well and how they feel on a day-to-day basis. And if something changes for a long period of time, you're better to be safe than sorry and go and get it checked.
Absolutely. And it's like really important to know what's your normal and what your body is like on a normal day when you're fit and healthy, and then picking up on those changes that do occur. And that sort of is what we at Cancer Smart are really trying to emphasize, is picking up on any persistent changes, any unusual changes, something that's not normal for you. So, you know, I just echo what you just said right now, like with understanding that there's something that's not quite right and getting it checked because you'd rather be safe than sorry. So I absolutely agree with everything you've said. And, you know, I'd like to ask Rob if he has any questions for you so far as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can fully agree with that. I mean, it was hard enough for me to accept the changes and what was wrong with me at 50, at 14, when your body is changing anyway. It must have been very hard to accommodate those changes and to take that step to say to somebody, look, this is not right, this is wrong. I mean, I put it off for nearly a year. I mean, did you think the same? I mean, I know you've said that I've seen the stigma, you know, the talk that you've done about the kid with cancer and coming to terms with the changes and how everybody at your school went, we accept the changes, and it was harder for you.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the thing. Like you say, it's your teenager. And I think more so the second time around as well, like the symptoms were coming back and I was actually trying to pin them on things being a teenager, like snapping at my friends. My friends were very vigilant when I was sort of, when I relapsed, I think a couple of them knew something wasn't right. Obviously they didn't really want to say to me, you should get checked, but they were saying like, look, mate, you are looking a bit paler than normal. And I would snap back at them like, well, it's the winter. Like I've been indoors a lot recently. Or I'm stressed with my exams because it was our GCSE year. So I think sometimes, like you say, Rob, it's like you try to categorize it into something that's completely normal for you. So that, because you know, I think a lot of the time we know something's not right, but it's that fear of actually accepting that. And honestly, hand on heart, anybody listening, when you actually do accept it and go and get checked, when you're told, it's like a massive weight being lifted off your shoulders. Even though you've been told something devastating, you're like, okay, I've got an answer to all of these things, which I've actually been worrying about for a long time and not told anybody about. Now I've got the answer to it. And now the consultant's going to spell out to me how they can treat it and get it sorted as quickly as possible.
And it's taking that step from that I know something's wrong, but I'm not going to do anything about it. And accept that change and have somebody help me and realize that, I mean, everyone, when people say the word cancer, it's like a death sentence, and it isn't, you know, it's just a change in life and a journey that you've got to take. And sometimes sadly there's different endings to what people want, but it's taking that step. And as you say, the second time around, it's not accepting that change. And it's something that I think we'll talk about later, but I know that yourself is that fear of the return. Yeah. I know you've talked about that a lot. I talk about it a lot. And, you know, I had a conversation at the weekend where you feel it never leaves you, and it's accepting that and taking that to say, look, something has changed again. I don't want to leave it 6 months, 12 months. I want to do something now and get that treatment back in place.
Exactly. It's like filling up a balloon, aren't you, at the end of the day, and these symptoms are slowly going, and if you catch it quick enough, then it's easier to fix. But if you carry on filling up, eventually it's going to burst, isn't it?
Yeah. Luckily. And like I would say, like with the second time round, I think just because you were more aware of the symptoms, you internally picked up that there's something wrong and it's serious, as opposed to the first time round when you were diagnosed. So like, you know, if you want to just talk about how it was like getting the diagnosis the second time round. I mean, you did mention how your friends did start noticing that something wasn't quite right with you. What about yourself personally and your internal thoughts? You know, what led you to finally speak to your doctor or consultant at that point?
It was a really, when I look back on it, it's a really like weird time, because the first symptom was, like I say, mini nosebleeds, and they started happening. And what, you know, one happened, okay, that's fine. You know, two, right, okay, that's okay. Three, okay, I'm going to start. I started Googling why I might be getting mini nosebleeds and ignoring anything that I saw that said cancer on it. And many things like, you know, changing in moving from an air conditioned room to the cold air outside, which is, you know, that's a reason that people get nosebleeds at the end of the day. But I was like, right, I'll do that. But obviously it wasn't. And then came a cold, and I had a cold in January, and that stuck with me for 2.5 months. And about 4 months down the line, mum was giving me sort of like, she's like, right, if this hasn't gone in 3 weeks' time, we're going for a blood test. And we went to get a blood test done, and they couldn't get blood out of my arm. And I was like, right, no, that's fine. This is stupid. Let's go. And I had the full-on argument with mum. And then in the end, she was like, okay, fine. I think she just sort of gave in and we left. That was my decision I made. It wasn't mum's. I made that decision to leave. I didn't want the blood test. I was going. And that's because I knew what they're going to find if they did a blood test, I think. And then, again, getting iller and iller and iller. And actually, when I plucked up the courage, I think the only reason I plucked up the courage on that day that I went to the hospital was because I couldn't hide it anymore physically. My lymph node was swollen up my neck. There was a physical thing there that you could see. That I had a bruise on my chin, which I told everybody that I'd banged on the sink, but I hadn't. It appeared over the night. And it does sound ludicrous to me now when I look at it, because I was like, it's like, Ryan, wake up, mate. Like, you need to go and get this checked, but you're not doing it. And eventually I did. And I was extremely, extremely lucky that lymph node decided to pop itself up on that day. For me to then go into hospital and get it checked. And actually, when the consultant pulled us into the room, really funny story. So, well, it's not funny, but still, yeah, really interesting story. But basically, the consultant that diagnosed me in A&E was a haematologist for the whole of the hospital within my area. He didn't deal with children, though. He was just a consultant on at that time. He's treated family members before. He treated my great-granddads and my nana and everything knew him, because we live in a county that's got quite a small hospital. And basically, I'd never seen him since that day in A&E. And then when I went to get the blood test done in hospital, we had the blood test done. And we got a call saying, they got your results. So he said to me, we've got the results back. And I said to him, I know. As soon as he said, we've got the results back, I said, I know. And he said, yeah, it has come back. And I said, yeah, I know. And I've known for a while. And then he basically said, look, we're going to give you a platelet transfusion. Because your platelets are so low, we're going to let you go home, and then Southampton are ready for you tomorrow to go up there. And I sort of took more ownership over it the second time around, I think, because I was not as unwell as I was the first time. So I told my dad. I've got a stepdad, and the dad was there. My biological dad was working in the hospital that day, so he came to see us anyway, and I told him. And then I sat my sisters down, and I told them when I got home, and I told my grandparents as well, because I wanted to tell them and sort of take more ownership of that diagnosis. Which was very difficult to do at 15. But then we got to hospital, and it was like returning home. You know, they'd had, you know, a day to prepare themselves for us to arrive. We had a bedroom ready for us, and they all welcomed us up. They knew what was going on. My consultant said to me, it was just really, really horrible. Well, not horrible, but she said to me, like, because of the type of AML you've got and the gene that you have, in a way, without sounding too horrible, I was waiting for this day for you to have to come back, unfortunately. Because the best treatment for AML is a stem cell transplant, because the register is so low, we can't rinse them. If there's a chance of chemotherapy or work, then they will opt for that to start off with. But I found it easier mentally, I think, once I'd gone and got diagnosed and it happened, because I knew what to expect and knew what was coming.
Yeah, and would you say, like, the second time around, even though you were hesitant to get that diagnosis and seek that medical advice, that it was a lot easier from the emotional side of things and like mental side of things to accept the diagnosis as opposed to the first time around when you were diagnosed?
Yeah, definitely. The first time around when I was diagnosed, like, you know, did the classic thing, kicking and screaming, why me? Why is this happening to me? Why not somebody else? Why not a criminal that sat in prison who's, you know, killed people before? Why is this happening to me? And I did that classic thing. And then eventually after about six, 7 weeks, I realized that kicking and screaming wasn't going to do anything. And I couldn't change that. So I had to accept the fact that I had cancer. And the second time round, I was just like, okay, right, we've got this to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, there's plus sides here. The ward's been updated. There's a nice flashy teenage room for me to spend my time in. I'm the only teenager on the ward. So yeah, I'm going to get to spend time in there. And I just look for the positives. As best as I could really in it the second time around. And I think because I knew what was coming, I knew I was going to have chemotherapy, I knew I was going to feel sick, I knew I was going to have these procedures, I knew I was going to have to give up a lot of my power in my own life. I was okay with that the second time around, and I just let it happen.
And I think you were familiar with the whole environment and what was involved. And I think as humans, we are less uncomfortable when we're placed in situations that we are familiar with. I think that it's when you experience change for the first time that's when we experience extreme like distress from such events. And I think that's why the second time around was a lot easier. And I noticed how you mentioned you were very open with your family members. So, you know, you told your little sisters that this is wrong with me, you told your grandparents, and obviously both your dads and your mum obviously knew. Do you think that your openness to talking about your cancer was something that came after the second diagnosis, or were you like that from the very beginning, you know, very open about talking about your cancer with friends and family? Is that something that developed over time?
So in terms of like when I was first diagnosed, we were still sort of pretty much in that world anyway when I relapsed, right. I suppose, because we'd only been there for 12 months. So, mm-hmm. you know, free for 12 months, we're still within that sort of cancer world in a way.
Yeah.
So it's still fresh in our mind. So I felt comfortable telling everybody. Don't get me wrong, the moment that I got out of hospital for my transplant, I cut cancer off completely. So everything that I do now, the work that I do now, that's fairly new, and it's fairly recent, because I put cancer in a little box as soon as I was discharged, in a little box back in my head, shoved it as far as I could, and I'm forgetting about this. And I moved to Edinburgh, which is a big old move, but I remember saying to myself when I moved to Edinburgh, looking at myself in the mirror the night before, saying, we're leaving cancer here, we're not going to talk about it in Scotland, this is a new start. Mm-hmm. And I used to do that all the time. I used to go to new jobs and be like, new starts, not mention cancer, and I'd go like 3 or 4 weeks and then something would come up and I'd have to mention it. And I used to be really gutted when it came up and I didn't want to tell people. I used to be like guilty. I used to feel guilty about it, as if like almost like I'd been to prison. I was telling somebody that I'd been to prison, and that's how I felt. It wasn't until the coronavirus pandemic, when I was sort of at home quite a bit and doing a lot of walking and listening to people's stories on podcasts and stuff, that I realized actually I can't shut something like this out, because it's been part of me for a long time. And I think when I got to that five years was during the pandemic since my transplant, I felt that safety net of like, okay, we're 5 years post transplant now, I feel quite safe, so I was going to start talking about it. And it was the best decision I ever made. And since I made that decision, I'm, you know, doing work on my page, trying to make sure people do it earlier, because the more I look at it, the more I realize that when I put cancer in its little box, through it back of my head, it was just eating away at different parts of my life, from things like my job to my mental health to my physical health, because of I chucked it in there and I'd ignored it. It was just fueling out and just leaking into different parts of my life. And sort of the moment I dealt with it and I confronted it, everything just seemed to sort of becoming that little bit easier. And it's still hard, obviously, like you said, Rob, yourself, like you always think about it and it happens, and that's fine, that's completely normal. And I think that's what I try to do, is to help people realize that it's completely normal, the feelings you have, and if you do want to shut it out, that's completely normal, but understand that talking about it is one of the best things that you can do.
Absolutely. And like, that's one of our objectives at Cancer Smite. It's making cancer that everyday conversation, normalizing it and tackling that stigma surrounding it. And like with Rob and I, both of us, I feel like initially we were quite like hesitant in talking about our cancers for a number of reasons, be it family or just that hesitancy, because I feel like for me personally, I just didn't understand cancer enough to be able to speak about it and explain it to other people. However, over time, like now I'm like 10 years cancer free, which is pretty amazing and something I'd never imagined my entire life, like when I was diagnosed. And I feel like with time, it just becomes a lot more easier speaking about it. I remember 1 year post-diagnosis and treatment completion, I'd say the big Z. I would never even say the word cancer because I was just so terrified by the word. And when I'd
like
be
Harry
revising...
Potter, isn't it? With Voldemort.
Yeah. Like I'd be revising biology and it says cancer. I'd be like, okay, big Z. Yeah. And then now it's like I actually feel like a different person just because I accepted what happened and I'm so much more open about talking about it. And I can see how much of a positive impact it has on other people around me who potentially are now being diagnosed or who have been diagnosed or who have family members. And I think Rob can definitely sort of relate to me on that note as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about it a lot more than when, you know, we first talked about it. I mean, I would never give it the credit of allowing it an uppercase C. It was always lowercase C for me because I would not do it. But there's so much that I could never hide. If I met somebody, their immediate reaction to me was, oh, what's wrong with your voice? Got a cold. Got this, because mine was on my vocal cords.
Yeah.
And I went nearly a year with very little voice, just getting worse and worse. And like yourself, put it to the back, ignored it, found every other excuse that I could to think what it was. But eventually, out of frustration of getting told off by my partner for not going, I went, and that's when mine rolled in. But it's this whole episode that we all go through. Seems to be the same for all of us. I mean, I was embarrassed. I wouldn't speak about it. I wouldn't do it. People would say to me, have you got a cold? And I'd just be upset. And people would go, you're never hiding this. You know, this is how your voice is going to be. And I pause when I speak because I have to do it. And after a long week of talking, it goes, and you talk too much and else. And one of the Macmillan nurses sort of said to us, look, you know, it's took losing it because they almost cut it all out. Took almost losing your voice to find it. And I will tell everybody, get checked, do this, stop that, don't do that. I work in construction and you see people even now cutting tarmac and concrete and plumes of dust everywhere. And it's like, stop, don't do that.
Yeah.
So I'm very much now, both of us, you know, we talk about it all the time, don't we? And we just bang on and bang on. And hopefully people take on the same yourself. I mean, I've looked at you, followed you, by the way, as well.
Oh, cheers, thank you.
So if you get one strange one, but anyway, I've listened to the videos and read it all, and I just see someone strong telling people to accept it and move on and not be embarrassed and not be ashamed. And this is stuff that we all went through. And I think everyone goes through that's had a journey through cancer.
That's the thing, I think. And I always say to people, first, thanks for the follow.
No problem.
Say to people as well, it's cancer is the sales experience of life. And anybody that's been for a job before, if you've gone for a job with sales experience, that job is instantly interested in you. Because if you can be a salesman, I've been a salesman for David Lloyd, if you can be a salesman, you can basically get yourself for anything. You've dealt with all different types of situations. People that don't want to buy things, people that come in really in your face, people that come in really angry at you. You dealt with everything. If you've been in sales, paperwork, X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And cancer's the same. It's got this massive negative light over it. You don't talk about it. But if you tell an employer or a future employer, and I think it's a big thing, and people, do I tell my employer? Do I not tell my employer? If you tell an employer that you've been through cancer, they are instantly interested in you straight away. And my dad said to me, he's really good at interviews, and I say, do I put it in my CV? And he say, put a little bit in your CV because you're guaranteed an interview if they read that, because they want to find out about it, because it's something people are interested in. And if you get that as well, they think, right, this person's been through X, Y, and Z. Like you say, they're resilient, they've got themselves through this, they've got the power now within them to accomplish anything. You chuck a work problem in front of them and it looks like a little pebble in the road to them, because it's not as big as the mountain that they've climbed over themselves, is it? That's the thing, isn't it? And I think it's just something people, when they start realizing that, and they start realizing actually it's not something, like I said, it's not something to be ashamed of. It's something people are incredibly proud of you.
Absolutely.
People are incredibly, they admire people that have been through it for it as well. it's something to be proud of, and to you. And like you say, we've been dealt it, and it's a difficult thing to be dealt. But I do a workshop on it as well in terms of cancer takes, and it's time once cancer's disappeared and you've had a treatment and you're on the other end of it, it's time for you to step back from cancer a bit and start taking some things back to that, because life's give and take, isn't it? And it's taken a lot. Let's let it give something back. And if that's your resilience and that's what you use as experience as well, then so be it.
And how would you say, like, you turned that cancer diagnosis into like a source of empowerment? Because, you know, you're so positive now, you're here using your cancer diagnosis and everything it's taught you, including that resilience, to make a difference out there in the real world. But, like, you know, how did it all start? How did you decide that, you know, that's it, I'm not going to let cancer bring me down, I'm going to utilize it to be the positive version of myself and also bring about that positive change and, you know, the difference you want to see in the world?
It's been a long ride, and the first time it started was essentially after my first round of chemotherapy, and I was sat in hospital and I was moaning and kicking off. And the first lesson that I was kind of dealt was a nurse, and I was having to take potassium tablets. Nobody has ever taken potassium tablets. They're literally the size of like a thumb. They're massive.
Yeah.
And I hate taking tablets anyway. And I was taking tablets, taking nine of them.
Wow.
And yeah, knocking them back. And the fourth one, I had it, got stuck in my throat and I threw up. And I started kicking off, like, why me? Why is this happening to me? And the nurse basically just said to me, gave some, dealt with some hard truth. I'm like, look, you're on a cancer ward. You're not in the cancer ward. Like, you're not in the right place to be moaning about why this happened to you. There's 15 other people out there that it's happening to as well. Yeah. And I've got hundreds of other patients underneath me who are dealing with exactly what you're dealing with. Not the only person in the world that's dealing with this. It took me back. I was a bit like, oh wow. But that's what I needed. And I finished my treatment, went home, and I remember sitting on bedroom at home and just being really down in the glumps and thinking, Ryan, you've got 6 months of this, mate. And if you're going to be negative and miserable for 6 months, it's going to be hard for you because the day is going to go longer and you're going to really struggle. It's going to be hard for your mum to watch because she doesn't understand she can't feel what I'm going through. It's going to be hard for her to watch. My sisters, my younger sisters, are going to watch me going through something. I'm going to be ill and really miserable as well. So I flipped it. And thought, right, let's try and make the best out of the situation. I started thinking, cool, I've got loads of time to watch TV with mum. I can watch films and stuff with mum. We used to have film nights on specific days. So even though we're in hospital all the time, we'd watch a film on a Friday and a Wednesday, and that'd be it. We watch TV on the other days. So we'd have days to look forward to. Spend more time with mum, more time to game. I've got time off school. That's always a positive, isn't it? I've got 6 months off school. I can get up whenever I want. I've got food brought to me, and then start using all these positives, everything as well. And then when I started using it for like empowerment was, again, the coronavirus pandemic. And the moment I dealt with it, I started realizing, actually through fitness, honestly, that's the first time I realized what it taught me was in fitness. And I was running. I was training for a bike ride for charity last summer, and I was running. I was on a run, running up a hill, and it was really tough. And I was moving, my legs were hurting, and I was thinking, oh, I want to stop running. I'm about 100 meters away. I want to stop running. I'll start walking. And then I was thinking to myself, Ryan, you've dealt with worse, mate. You've had poison pumped through your vein. Why do you want to stop? Your leg was almost cut off. Like, keep running. It's 100 meters. Like, if you can sit in a hospital bed for 6 months, you can run 100 meters with your legs hurting a little bit. And that's when that sort of started coming. And the more that I started thinking about it, the more I started realizing it was teaching me the perspective on things. You know, I think that perspective that cancer patients have is different to everybody else. We've all got that understanding of how precious life is and how nothing's guaranteed than what's happened a minute ago. That's what was guaranteed, because it's gone. You can't guarantee what's going to happen in a second. Nobody can. And when you realize that, you start to realize actually life's not for cruising through and doing X, Y, and Z. Life's really for just sort of getting on with it and doing what you want to do to make you happy. And I put a tweet out the other day actually asking cancer patients, you know, do they have this weird sense of the norm would never be enough after cancer. And I do think that a lot of people it's happened to after that, it's like, yeah, well, I can't just, you know, do X, Y, and Z. I want to go and do things now. And I want, within my ability, what I can do, I want to go and do that. And you see it and this spark. And then when you start igniting that spark within cancer patients, they start to do some incredible things. And it's really nice to watch.
Absolutely. And I feel like just through changing your perspective, it had a positive impact on your attitude because you viewed your situation from a different perspective that I'm not alone. There's so many other children, for example, who have cancer, and that I could think of it negatively. I could think that, you know, I'm ill. I have to take all these tablets. I absolutely hated taking tablets and liquids and everything as well. So I can completely relate. And you could be like, you know, I want to be at school, meet my friends, go out, and I'm here stuck in the hospital. However, you saw the positives to it, you know, that extra time you got with your family, you know, you got to wake up when you wanted, stay at home, not go to school and stress about work like your friends. So I guess just through changing your perspectives, perspective and having those positive thoughts, you were able to foster positive feelings, and that led to the positive actions that you've, you know, now implemented into your life through raising awareness and being so open. And I'm sure it's sort of motivated you from the sports and fitness side as well. Like you mentioned, you know, you pushed through running however many kilometers it was because you knew that if you can get through having poison, like you said, in your veins and that deadly diagnosis, you can also do the many different things in life that you've always wanted and hoped to do. And I think a lot of cancer patients and cancer survivors feel that once they've been diagnosed, it really changes how you view the world and what you want to achieve. Like you could want to do like regular things like just travel or chill and, you know, hang out with friends. But I think once you've been through cancer, it kind of gives you that purpose in life. You've been given this second chance and you just don't want to waste it. You want to do anything as little, as big as making a difference in a positive way and spreading positivity through your story. And I think a lot of people who go through these dark nights or dark days kind of find this light at the end of it. And they, I feel, are the light. They are the ones that are able to bring hope to others because they utilize their story and their experiences to bring about that positivity. So I feel like you are a perfect example of that. And I'm just so happy that you shared, you know, how you changed your situation and flipped it around to be the way that you wanted it, really.
That's the thing, like you say, my dad always says, I think, but like his perspective is the main thing. My dad's always said to me, I'm very lucky, I've got two very positive parents. And there's in life, you've got hard facts that are real things. So like the chair I'm sat on right now is an actual thing of matter. It's reality. Your cancer is a thing of matter. It's reality. You are. But your thoughts and your feelings, they are things you've created within your head. Fear, sadness, anger, being upset by something, being embarrassed by it. It's not actually something. It's something you've created in your head, which equally you can change as well. So if you want to change it, it's just about changing perspective on things and thinking, actually, you know what? No, I'm not going to be angry at this. I'm going to see how this is going to make me grow as a person instead. I'm not going to be embarrassed by this. I'm going to be proud of this. And if someone doesn't back me for being proud, then I don't spend time with them anymore.
They're not the right people.
Exactly, not the right people. And that's what it's about. It's about flipping that mentality. And it's not just for cancer, it's for anything in life, difficult things in life as well.
Absolutely.
You see people all the time, they flip their mentality, don't they? And it, movies, example, you see it in the movies, the classic movie strapline, isn't it? How it runs, you know, somebody goes through something difficult, they're angry at it, their mentality flips. Batman, for example, you know, parents are shot, falls down a well, angry at it, flips mentality, becomes a superhero. Like it's the same. That's how it works, and that's exactly how life works. You know, that's how people can really empower themselves to do amazing things. And if everyone was to do that, then everyone would be millionaires. If everyone did that on every opportunity, anything happened.
Exactly, I completely agree with everything you've said. And you know, just to wrap things up, is there like a message you want to give out to our listeners who've tuned in today, based on your own experience of having cancer twice and coming out the other end and making such a positive change in the world today?
Yeah, sure. I'll read that Dear Cancer letter from my blog post. It says, Dear Cancer, you came into my life when I was just 14, plagued my bloodstream with your confused, immature cells, simply seeking to do a job they thought they weren't supposed to do, unaware that they were slowly killing me with the mistakes they made. Since then, you've become like an old friend to me. The memories I have with you are fortified in my head forever, good and bad. As an illness, you've taught me so much. But first, I need to give you a bit of a lesson. I've watched as you've consumed the lives of families I've never met, absorbed and lashed out at children barely old enough to have celebrated a Christmas before. I've watched you tear innocent, lovely, kind families apart in your quest to seek the ultimate fate we can pay as humans to you. Yet you fail, though you win some battles, you fail. Because as a species, we've not fallen and given in to you. We continue to thrive against you. We create new ways to battle you. We find new treatments to make you more bearable. Despite the horrific events you bring to our over this entire planet, you've taught me so much. Cancer, without you, I wouldn't be me. And so for me to be me, I needed you. You taught me the value of why it's important to not give in to you. You taught me what's important in life. You showed me the hardest and darkest parts of my own soul, whilst empowering me with every minute I spent there to never return to those pits again. You have helped me grow, succeed, and motivate me to do better. You've given me a story to share and a way to do it. You've allowed me to be better, a better version of myself. And though the fear of your ultimate goal ever taking first place on my life's agenda, for me, Cancer, you're an old friend, one I tried to ignore but realised I couldn't. You're my teacher, my motivator, and my dark counterpart. Without you, I wouldn't be here today. I would have a different life for sure. But what's the point in dwelling on events you have no control over? I hate you, I thank you, and I respect you. Best regards, your tougher counterpart.
Wow, that was so amazing. I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that, Ryan. It was a beautiful, beautiful letter. And I feel like it's just shown how Cancer wasn't the boss, you were the boss. And you turned that negative situation into something so positive. I'm sure Rob will agree. It was an incredible experience hearing your story and your inspiring words. Do you have anything else to say, Rob?
I can only agree with that. It's been a true pleasure to meet you and listen to your story, your journey, and your future plans to bring acceptance to the world, really. I mean, it's so enlightening to see someone so young and so keen to show the world that there is a journey through the end. And I'm very proud to have met you today. Thank you for coming up.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So that brings us to the end of another episode of You Can Survive, Let's Talk About Cancer. We really hope you felt inspired by Ryan's story today, because we certainly did. If you have been experiencing any signs or symptoms persisting for more than 2 to 3 weeks, like Ryan, then we would urge you to see your GP as soon as possible. These include pale skin, tiredness, breathlessness, high temperature or feeling hot or shivery, excessive sweating, frequent infections, easily bruised skin, bleeding gums or nose, or swollen glands in the neck or armpit region. These are just some of the symptoms you may experience if you have leukemia, and we recommend that you check the NHS website for a comprehensive list. Thank you. This podcast is brought to you by the West Yorkshire and Harrogate Cancer Alliance and patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. To find out more, visit us on our website, that's www.yorkshirecancercommunity.co.uk/cancersmile. Thank you.